This is Thursday, the 8th of August, 2004. August 12th, 8th month, 12th day. And which is Andrew's birthday, that's true. And I'm George Dole. My topic is titled is Conquest Strategy, and we're at the Freiburg New Church Assembly. When we undertake to discover spiritual meaning in any of the books of the Bible except Genesis, Exodus, and Revelation, we're launching forth into relatively uncharted waters, since Genesis, Exodus, and Revelation are the only books treated in detail in Swedenborg's published theological works. There have been significant efforts to apply the principles of correspondence to other books, with McLagan in particular having worked very carefully with a number of the historical books, but to my mind, these treatments tend to ignore Swedenborg's own advice to work from generals to particulars. Instead, they proceed from detail to detail, from word to word, and it would take a great deal of time and effort to build an overall coherent spiritual story out of the dense and detailed assignments of correspondential meaning. Well, it must be granted, I think, that we don't usually read a story in general and then read it again in detail. We can, of course, skim through a book and then decide whether it's worth a closer reading, but by and large, the more common practice is to let the book itself dictate how closely it deserves to be read. If it's a story, and one of my principal premises is that the Bible is first and foremost a story, then we operate with a kind of suspended judgment. We don't decide what the full meaning of a particular incident is until we have seen how things work out. We don't decide whether this character is one of the good guys or one of the bad guys until the end of the book. And we find out sometimes to our surprise that our first impressions have been wrong. But once we reach the end of the story, if the story is well constructed, then we see how things fit together. And in this way, we actually do refrain from assigning meaning to details until we have seen the general pattern. This being the case, it's important to have the general shape of the biblical story in mind when we come to look at specific segments of it. Most broadly, I'd urge that we see God's call to Abram in Genesis 12 as an image of our childhood sense of promise, how wonderful it's going to be when we grow up. The exodus from Egypt as our own declaration of independence at the time of puberty. The Sinai covenant as our encounter with the rules that come down on us when we venture outside the shelter of the home and into that very forbidding world of peer pressure. Skipping over this morning's topic, the conquest of the promised land, I would see the establishment of the monarchy as our establishment of an independent adult identity, the fall of Israel and Judah as the midlife failure of that identity, and then the birth of the Lord comes as the spiritual awakening that can follow only when we do admit that failure, and the descent of the Holy City, the image of that acceptance of heaven into ourselves that is the key to our acceptance into heaven. And all of this seems to me to follow fairly easily from the overall shape of the literal story. The establishment of an earthly kingdom, its failure, the transformation of that expectation into the expectation of a heavenly kingdom. You stop in the Gospels, you no longer talk about the coming of the kingdom, the reestablishment of the kingdom of Israel. Jesus talks, John the Baptist talks of the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God. And it also seems to follow well from a closer examination of the various phases of the narrative. So if we take the descent of the holy city as the goal of the whole story, then without looking for explicitly spiritual meaning, details, we can see the Lord drawing the chosen people in that direction right from that first call to Abram. And the more clearly we understand how a particular episode functions in that story, the more clearly we'll be able to see its spiritual import. So with that in mind, let's turn to the story of the conquest. Now, at the time, in just a little footnote, George spoke of how long it took them to get from the Red Sea to the border of the Holy Land. Didn't take them long at all. They went right straight up there. Then they sent the spies in. And the spies said, we'll never make it. Then they went back into the wilderness. But they took a fairly straight line the first time. And at the time they were finally poised to cross the Jordan, the Promised Land was theoretically an Egyptian province. But Egypt was in decline, and its actual control of the Holy Land seems to have been minimal. There's a fairly extensive archive of letters found at Tel El Amarna in Egypt. These are letters from eminent Canaanites, and they show what looks to be a complete fragmentation. The head of one city is writing to Pharaoh, asking for help because he's under attack by the army of another city. And from time to time, there'll be a letter from that other city complaining about what prompted this, or that saying, no, we're the ones that are getting attacked by the other. And there's no evidence that Egypt did anything about it at all. Well, in the book of Joshua, these leaders are given the title king. And it's important to bear in mind that these are not kings of nations or territories. They're kings of city-states, nearer in size to Bridgeton than to Boston. That is, each of these kings governed a little walled city and the surrounding fields and groves and vineyards that constituted its economic base. And the army of each city consisted primarily of the men who worked these fields and groves and vineyards. So when the need arose, they would quite literally beat their plowshares into swords and their pruning hooks into spears. And when hostilities ceased, they'd beat their swords back into plowshares and their spears back into pruning hooks, because metal was in short supply. And incidentally, I believe it's in the prophet Joel, we're more familiar with the command to beat your swords into plowshares than with the reverse, but the reverse does occur. A call to war, beat your plowshares into swords, beat your pruning hooks into spears. I think it's in Joel, I'm not sure. So, according to Joshua 12, verse 24, Joshua defeated 31 kings within the borders of the Promised Land. 31 kings in an area not all that much larger than New Hampshire. And in the first chapter of Judges, we're told of another 19 cities or regions that were not defeated. So clearly, there was no single capital city or central government that could be taken over. And Joshua's conquest was not the conquest of a nation called Canaan, because there was no such nation. Well, because these cities were small, they did need to trade with each other. And in particular, the mountainous territory of the south was much better suited to olive groves and vineyards than it was to the cultivation of grain or the grazing of cattle. You don't find many cattle ranches in the mountains. Excavations of ancient cities show fairly long lapses of time between the destruction layers, layers of burning that show a major conquest. And this, together with the Amarna correspondence, suggests that the normal state of affairs was a kind of uneasy truce. And the Amarna letters do make it clear that this truce was fragile. There was no love lost between or among these little city-states. And if one particular city was attacked by another, that was no particular cause for alarm. It might have been a cause for some satisfaction, because now this city that we were worried about has problems of its own that will distract it, and it won't cause problems for us. And both sides will come out weaker, and if we can stay out of the fight, then we'll come out ahead. But in the 10th chapter of Joshua, we find that when the king of Jerusalem heard that the Israelites had destroyed Jericho, taken Ai, and made an alliance with Gibeon, he did put together a coalition of four other kings, all from the southern part of the Holy Land, and attacked Gibeon. The Gibeonites appealed to Joshua, who caught the coalition by surprise after an all-night march. His victory was complete. It ended with the execution of these kings, five kings, and was followed by a series of quite complete victories over several other significant southern cities. Now, if we look at the geography of the region, this makes a great deal of sense. As I mentioned last week, the primary access to the southern mountains, the hill mountainous country down here, is from the north. You have steep slopes, barren slopes down to the Dead Sea. You have desert down here. You have not as steep as the eastern slopes, but steep slopes here, and access primarily through a limited number of valleys, wadis. The main one, though, still is the Valley of Ajalon, coming up roughly here. So the easiest access is from the north. By moving from Jericho to Ai, the alliance with Gibeon, and the defeat, the time the sun stood still at the head of the Valley of Ajalon, Joshua effectively cut the country in half. He cut off that essential line of communication between north and south. The Israelites then would be in essential control of trade between south and north, and neither south nor north could afford to see that happen. And this was much more of an immediate threat to the relatively isolated communities in the south than those in the north. In the north, as you'll recall from a number of things said last week, you had the main roads from Mesopotamia to Egypt, and even from the north, from the Hittite country coming through there. They were not nearly so isolated. So it makes sense then that the first coalition would be formed in what would later become the land of Judah. And there is a striking parallel to this in Israel's own history. The book of Judges presents a picture of the settled tribes as just about as decentralized as the Canaanites and other ites were in the time of the conquest. Coalitions forming to deal with particular local threats under particular judges, but hostility and even open warfare at times between the tribes, especially toward the close of the period. And as I mentioned last Monday, the great move toward unity came only when the Philistines proved to be more than a local threat, when they became a chronic problem. So Israel uniting under Samuel and Saul is very, very similar, so to let's say politically, to these southern kings uniting against the threat of Israel. And then Joshua's defeat of the southern coalition evidently alarmed the northern cities, and the king of Hazor, north of the Sea of Galilee, gathered what sounds like an even larger coalition. The 11th chapter of Joshua tells of the rout of this coalition, and it's in the 12th chapter that we find the summary I've already mentioned, with its total of 31 kings defeated. Well, to see what this might reflect in our own spiritual lives, I would like to review briefly the geographical and spiritual difference between south and north that I dealt with at some length last week. Basically, as I just said, the north was open to the outside world and cosmopolitan. The south was relatively secluded and provincial. And this strikes me as wonderfully appropriate to Swedenborg's identification of the south as corresponding to the heart, to our feelings, the north to our minds, to our thinking processes. That is, we are generally more conscious of what we're thinking than we are of the feelings that underlie and actually give quality to our thoughts. And the process of regeneration starts with the mind, with self-examination. We share our thoughts quite freely, sometimes more freely than we might. I'm reminded of the bumper sticker that says, "Everyone is entitled to my opinion." We share our feelings only with the people we've come to trust. The whole territory of the Promised Land represents our inner life, with the surrounding lands representing our interaction with the world around us. So with this in mind, the story of the conquest becomes an image of our efforts to deal with our own inner enemies. This is a task we find ourselves faced with from time to time, often over and over again throughout our lives, but in the larger sweep of the biblical narrative, it's particularly appropriate, I think, to what we might call mid-adolescence. That is, taking the Exodus from Egypt has a very vivid image, and it can be of that declaration of independence that's characteristic of puberty. The wilderness wandering that follows has very much the feel of the harsh times that follow that, in which we're very much at the mercy of outward forces, when peer pressure is everything, and when there are such rules, there are things we cannot possibly seem dead wearing. There are things that we cannot possibly say or do, or we will be socially destroyed. There's a span of time then in which our primary concern is to survive in an interpersonal world that we do experience as threatening. We desperately need the approval of our peers. We're preoccupied with the rules of dress and behavior and language that we have to follow if we're not to be ostracized. And our exit from this wilderness comes only when we disempower that social world around us, so to speak, by paying attention to who we actually inwardly are. And this means awakening to the fact that we can't go on forever blaming all our troubles on the people around us and trying to conform to their expectations. We must try to discern who we are and what responsibility we ourselves bear for our own misery or our own happiness. And the first glimpse of this step that lies ahead of us is apparently more than we can handle. The spies are sent in and come back with a land that, while the promise is tremendous, the land is occupied by hostile giants. At first glance, we can see no hope whatever of defeating our fundamental childish sense of self-importance, of rightness, of smallness in the face of the hugeness of the world we are entering. But three factors combine to overcome this fear. One is certainly the continued harshness of the wilderness, and combined with that sense of promise. Constant anxiety about how we look in the other eyes of others is exhausting. It renders us, gives us a sense of personal worthlessness. We have no value of our own. The thought that we might actually be worth something in our own right, regardless of what others think of us, has an immense appeal. The second is the leadership of Joshua, an image of truth fighting, or I'd like to think of it now as a certain measure of real, just simple, uncompromising honesty. The rationalizations we've relied on don't work anymore. They seem childish to us, and we don't want to be children anymore. And the third is that this inner land is terribly disorganized. We haven't constructed any strong sense of identity. We have no sense of wholeness to defend. We're all bits and pieces. We're all fragments. Then Jericho, as a city right on the border of the Promised Land down in the Jordan Valley, which at that point is one of the lowest spots on the face of the earth, is an appropriate picture of the literal sense of Scripture. In a broader sense, and I think we need always to be able to make this kind of extension, a sense applicable to people who aren't raised on the Bible, and this is their story too. It's a picture of the basic facts of life as laid down by whatever is accepted as authority. This is the way the world works. This is the way things happen. That's all there is to it. And as such, it's the beginning of that strike across the center of the Promised Land that separates the South from the North, the beginning of our effort to take control over our inner lives. And it amounts to saying to ourselves, okay, that's the way the world works. It's time to stop grumbling about the rules and figure out how to work with them. They may tell me what I must and mustn't do, but I don't need to let them control my attitudes. I don't need to let them make me miserable. I don't need to give them that power. And once we have this foothold in the Promised Land, then we're poised to take a crucial step. That is, if we're to take charge of our inner lives, we need above all to be able to distinguish how we feel from how we think, from what we think. This is that separation of will and understanding that makes the adult process of regeneration possible. The separation that enables us for the first time actually to become conscious of our feelings and to think about them, to observe them. We no longer simply are what we feel. Feelings are what we have. Things are not true anymore simply because they gratify us. Things are not false anymore simply because they get in our way or disturb us. And the implications of this step are far-reaching. If we take it, it means letting go of some of our pet attitudes. We may, for example, have to admit that someone we really don't like is actually a pretty decent person. And we may have to admit that our resentment of someone else was simply and basically, not simply, things are never simple, basically an expression of our own sense of inadequacy. And in general, we may have to recognize the extent to which we have tended to put other people down in order to keep ourselves up. And this is one of the primary functions of junior high cliques, social cliques. And I suspect that this coalition of five Southern kings pictures our realization of the extent to which we have seen other people and ourselves through the distorted lens of our own fears. I suspect that, again, this was last Sunday's sermon, that the single divine command that we find most frequently in the Gospels is, fear not. Well, in the language of object relations theory, this is moving from a state in which we are those feelings to a state in which we are individuals who have those feelings. We become capable of objectifying them, deciding what weight to give them. We move from knee-jerk reaction to reflective decision. And it isn't an easy move to make because the admissions we are faced with are painful. We have a great deal invested in our sense of self-importance. Largely, or at least contributing to this, is our unacknowledged sense that we don't really believe other people think we are important. But once we make the step, we discover we haven't come apart at the seams. Not only that, because we have come through the struggle intact, we now feel more secure than we did before. And in the biblical story then, victories over Libna, Lachish, Eglon, Hebron, and Debir seem to follow the defeat of the coalition, southern coalition, almost as a matter of course. And there are, yes, there are other cities left untouched, but there's no further organized resistance. And it's evidently this measure of territorial control that prompts the formation of the Northern Coalition. As I mentioned earlier, severing ties with the South was no great threat to the North because the Northern Territory had open access to the rest of the world. And as long as the Southern Territory was its usual disorganized and fragmented self, it posed no threat. But the prospect of a relatively unified territory with obvious military clout and aggressive intentions was something else again. Because the obvious line of expansion of any such kingdom was simply to the north. Everything. This is a cul-de-sac. If these people had taken over down here and they wanted to expand, and everybody wanted to expand, then the only direction was north. Well, in the spiritual story, once we detach ourselves from our feelings to some appreciable extent, we are faced with the necessity of some serious rethinking. Because it isn't just our pet attitudes that need to be changed, it's a number of our pet notions as well. And we may find ourselves needing to admit that someone else has been right when we have been wrong. But we have been obliged to believe that we were right and they were wrong because we didn't like them. We may need to recognize that winning an argument is not the same as discovering what is true. And especially those opinions in which we have invested our self-esteem are likely to rise up and protest. We hold them dear because of what we have invested in them. But it's precisely because of that investment that they're likely to be distorted and flawed. And what we bring to this new struggle, then, is the progress we have made by our ability to detach from our feelings. We're capable, that is, of recognizing that we have taken a particular position because it bolstered our self-esteem, and as the need to bolster that self-esteem dwindles, the weaknesses of the position we take become more obvious. And Joshua, the truth fighting, can handle this, can meet this, and can meet it head on. The most specific clue our theology offers as to the more precise meaning of this northern enemy comes in paragraph 3048 of Secrets of Heaven, where Hazor, the principal city of the northern coalition, is identified as meaning, and I quote, "people who take to information about heavenly and spiritual things solely for the purpose of being thought wise and intelligent by themselves and the world." And this, I would suggest, is precisely the kind of religious smugness that's characteristic of fragile egos. The primary pet notion that we have to debunk is the belief that we have some special understanding of deep truth, that we have deeper insights than ordinary people, and we find satisfaction in thinking that we are wise, we want to impress the world around us with our wisdom. And again, once this leading principle of our early adolescent self-absorption is unmasked, that is the end of organized resistance. But there's an interesting ambivalence at this point in the story. It says in Joshua 11:23, "So Joshua took the entire land, just as the Lord had directed Moses." Two chapters later, though, chapter 13, verse 1, "When Joshua was old and well advanced in years, the Lord said to him, 'You are very old, and there are still very large areas of land to be taken over.'" Well, this makes far more sense spiritually than it does literally. Literally, the two statements directly contradict each other. They cannot have taken the entire land if there are still very large areas of land to be taken. But spiritually, it's perfectly understandable that we should have an immense feeling of accomplishment after a major victory, a feeling that finally we've got things sorted out, finally everything is under control, and that before long we would discover that, oh, there's still a lot of work left to be done. Old patterns of thought do not vanish completely just because we have seen how they are false. We may be able to cope with them much better, but they still recur. Our minds still tend to run in similar patterns. Well, the main thing that happens after the listing of the conquered kings is the apportionment of the land to the 12 tribes, which must necessarily represent a kind of inner organization, the establishment of priorities. As I mentioned previously, our inner life has been relatively haphazard. Feelings would arise, thoughts would occur to us more or less spontaneously, and parents of children going through this phase tend to report they're never sure who their children are going to be from one day to the next. They're never sure who's going to come downstairs to breakfast. But in mid-adolescence, there is a tendency to assume a fairly stable outward identity, a feeling that we know who we are. It doesn't mean we're completely focused or consistent. It does mean that we have a kind of basis on which we can evaluate our inconsistencies. We can see some of our attributes as characteristics as central, and others as optional, peripheral. We begin to feel that we know what we should take seriously and what we can shrug off. And while there's a big difference between a high school freshman and a high school senior, there's normally enough stability to provide for some sense of continuity over those years of growth. All four classes can coexist in the same school with a sense that they're engaged in different stages of a common enterprise. Seniors have some memory of what it's like to be freshmen. Freshmen can begin to believe that someday they'll be seniors. There's a far bigger gap between a freshman in high school and someone, say, in sixth grade than there is between a freshman in high school and a senior in high school. So there's a kind of initial modeling of adulthood, not yet the real thing. In the normal run of things, teens are still dependent on the support system of home for food and shelter, the support system of school for the equivalent of a professional life. And in the biblical narrative, there is still the chaotic period of the judges, there is still the tragic story of Saul to go through before Israel becomes an independent nation. and then a whole new chapter of spiritual life begins, into which I am not going to delve, so the floor is yours. Ken.
I couldn't help but notice the parallel between your comment or your point that we don't change our thinking overnight and George's comment in this passage about truths have more validity that are accepted over time than right in the moment.
And it occurred to me in that connection, the image from the Gospels, that seed is planted, so it springs up and grows, and we don't know how. Yeah, George.
I'd like to have you amplify a little bit, you know, the project I'm working on, the verse-by-verse exposition of the Minor Prophets.
Yeah.
It is absolutely amazing with the research how much verse-by-verse exposition there is for the Minor Prophets. All of them. Now, there are a few verses that are... You know, I'm keen on the fact that the Lord doesn't want us just to study Genesis, Exodus, and Revelation.
Yeah.
I think he wants us, challenges us to find the spiritual sense of these other books of the Word. So I'm not sure I heard you correctly. I'm absolutely convinced with my research that scattered here, there is a systematic, almost verse-by-verse exposition.
Now, what I have in mind, in part, I think it follows necessarily as a matter of theological principle that nothing physical ever occurs that doesn't have spiritual meaning in it. And that what is really distinctive about the Word is not just that it has spiritual meaning, but that that is a coherent and consecutive. That's why I think the to view it as a story is absolutely essential. And to as I say, when you read a story, you know, there's no way you can read the generals before you read the particulars. You have to go through it, but I would urge just sort of keeping a kind of suspended judgment as to what this is doing in this place until some kind of picture of overall direction and connectedness, because any number of times it will say, you know, on the surface this looks disconnected, but under the surface it's beautifully connected. And if that beautiful connection, I think it's only as that beautiful connection begins to appear that we are can begin to say, now I see what this is about. There's no way to get there without, in one sense, without going detail by detail. So which is why I'd urge the policy of sense of, yeah, look at the details, but suspend judgment and keep try to see the overall pattern. I see Lee back there. Yeah.
Well, two things relating to that whole idea of the generals to the particulars. When you were talking about the McLagan commentary saying it goes right into the details, I was thinking about the Arcana, where in fact Swedenborg does give a general overview of the chapter by sometimes whole chapter, but usually by range of verses, and he gives a general picture of the spiritual sense before delving into the details. So in fact, he does actually follow his own dictum of going from generals to particulars in the way that he exposits Genesis and Exodus in the Arcana.
He moves in that direction. He never does that, for as far as I'm aware, for more than a chapter at a time, in a sense of giving an overview of a book, let alone an overview of Genesis to Revelation. You do have the 7 days outlined at the very beginning as an overview of the whole process, but that is not tied to the scriptural story.
Now, a few more things come to mind. One is that there has been an effort, which I haven't read with this in mind, to give a general overview of the spiritual sense, and that's by Lewis G. Hake in his book, The Tree of Life, which is published in 4 parts, only 2 of which I have left, but anyone who's interested can pick up parts 3 and 2, well, 2 of them. I forget which they are. There's 4 of them very cheaply. And he actually goes chapter by chapter throughout the entire inspired Word of God, giving the spiritual meaning. And what I've read of it is very nice, but I haven't read with the thought of, does he really provide the overview that you'd want of the whole story?
Yeah.
Another one, of course, that does it is the Anita Dole Bible Study Notes, which has a scheme of every year you bring the children through the entire, the classes through the entire Bible story by looking at high points along the way. You do that 4 years in a row using slightly different stories, and I think that may be why those who come through our Sunday schools seem to have a better sense of the whole Bible story than those going through other Sunday schools, simply because she seemed to take that to heart and design her notes specifically with that in mind to give the overall sense or overall view of the story as a connected whole.
Yeah, that was very high on her agenda. She realized from years of Sunday school teaching that if you had a four-year curriculum to get from Genesis to Revelation, then by the time the kids, especially with the younger children, by the time they got to Revelation, Genesis was back when they were in a different class even. And there was no overall sense of continuity. Also, I would call your attention to the fact that the Tree of Life is online and available in PDF format. It was put there by, what's his name? Namely Lee. Dean and then Mary.
George Moore of a comment when at our church, the stories of the conquest, the literal stories, are some of the hardest stories to defend in our faith.
Yeah.
You know, it's just really, people will come who are just visiting and say, what is going on here? That you're describing genocide. You know?
Yeah.
It's a real hard one.
Yeah.
Jump from there. Well, inside, we're talking about ourselves and how we have to wipe something out. But sometimes people don't want to make that leap.
In biblical scholarship currently, there is an immense effort to totally rewrite the story of the conquest as a story of the liberation of the oppressed. As far as I can see, it's a Don Quixotic, quixotic effort, but it just doesn't work. And to me, one of the most direct ways of saying this is one of the things that's divine about the Bible is that it really shows us shows us as we are.
Yes.
It doesn't idealize us, and it shows us divinity trying to get through to us and having a terrible, terrible time doing it, because we keep, in a sense, the Lord keeps saying, "Come to me," and our attitude is says, "Okay, get out of my way," and we'll just demolish anybody we see as standing in our way. With hard truth, we're so sure we're right. Yeah. And it finally dawned on me that we in reading the story, we tend to forget that it is the God we worship who was God back then, and that God loved those Canaanites and was providing them with a path to heaven. He loved those idolaters. Yeah, Marilyn and Laura and...
When you talk about the path of the individual going through and meeting the different steps along the way, I wonder where you would fit in the development of compassion and understanding in the life of charity, and how that fits in with the intellectual understanding and the changing in your lives.
Mm-hmm. I think In the biblical story, there is a huge thing that happens, and it's amazing that it didn't strike me more forcefully long ago. All through the story of the divided kingdom, every king is judged on the basis of, I did some of this last week, of worship practices. Did they insist that all worship should happen at the temple in Jerusalem? Did they destroy the altars to other gods? Did they knock down the high places and so on and so forth? And this goes back to Deuteronomy 12 with its passionate insistence that you're not to go building altars all over the place and sacrificing any place you feel like. All your sacrifices are supposed to be brought to the one place the Lord God will choose. And then you turn to the first chapter of Isaiah. And he says, "I am sick of your offerings and your sacrifices. Your incense stinks. What do I have to do with all this blood? I want justice. I want mercy." And that I think is the pivotal turn in the story. And that becomes, you hear very little all through 1st and 2nd Kings about matters of justice. The story of Naboth's vineyard is really about the only one. But it's all about religious reform, about cultic worship matters. Josiah was wonderful because he rebuilt the temple. Jehu was wonderful because he destroyed the worshippers of Baal. There's very little about whether they did anything for widows and orphans and the poor, and so on and so forth. But then you turn into the prophets, and bam, it's just the hidden agenda comes right to the top. And Jeremiah is saying, you keep talking about the temple of the Lord, it's a lie. Laura Colgate and Lois, yeah.
Lee Dyer has been delighting me this session with the out of the mouths of Dave's vision of my class. We've been doing familiar stories of divine providence this week, and Noah just building the ark when he was told it was translated to stop whining and get it done. Last week there were discussions on the way home with the young girls where Liz kept saying, well, and the inner meaning of that is, and one of the other girls finally said, well, we don't have inner meaning in our church. And Liz says, our church is kind of like Aesop's fables. Behind every story there's another story. That was a great way to put it, that, you know, some of these stories are so difficult, but what, you know, the kids got is like, okay, well, there's something behind it. No, they were last week. Why are we studying the tabernacle anyway? What does this have to do with anything? But to be able to take the inner meaning and really apply it, it was really cool to have her come up with that little 8-year-old metaphor for how to do it.
Yeah. Colgate, then Lois.
I just want to weigh in on process, in the sense that as a designer, I can have an instinct or a concept that might not be fully formed, but it provides order as I go forward and do research and try to find the detail in the pieces and put it together. Mm-hmm. Or I can start from a detail, a particular, and find other particulars, but at some point I have to form a synthesis to establish an order in order to put something new. So I was just saying that the process that one might go through could start at the particular, or it could start at a global understanding. But without overall order, you can never put the pieces together and make something new.
Yeah. And the one thing you can't do if you start with a particular is to say, I know right where this belongs, and I'm going to keep it there for the rest of the process.
You can't do that.
You can't do that. If you do that, it's a recipe for disaster. Lois.
I was just thinking how wonderful it is that the more we understand the way the young people go through some of these states as we're working with them, it helps us to know how not to fight but to feed what they're happening in their lives along these avenues. And I think it's really wonderful when we can delve under and find out how what they're going through.
Mm-hmm. Because sometimes we don't remember.
Well, we weren't cognitive of it as we were ourselves.
Yeah. Marilyn, did that get at what you were asking?
Well, it was kind of an introduction to what I was asking.
I think it's just, it struck me as more, this is more of a comment, is how interesting it is that as we divide ourselves at that age where we separate the will and the understanding or the head and heart and try to sort that out, that this is also the time when we have that real desire and that need for our peer relationships and how we crave that strong, deep relationship with another partner, and that's when we first come to that realization. I'm wondering now if that isn't some sort of a spiritual compensation going on or something where you're trying to attach to another, you know, part to figure out that how to rejoin the head and heart, which we do as we regenerate later on.
I'm very fond of Keegan's the evolving self. This is object relation theories, and he sees the whole process, our whole growth process, and for him it's psychological, quote, rather than spiritual, which is a line that is certainly blurred in our church, as fueled by the tension between our need for autonomy and our need for relationship. And if we get involved in relationship to the extent that we lose our sense of individuality, we're smothered. And if we get wrapped up in our individuality to the sense of being cut off from others, we're terribly lonely. And we don't actually find a balance. We spiral, he says. And we keep doing, making the same trip on deeper and deeper levels. And it to me, it resonates so nicely with a number, the whole cycle and epicycle theory, with the doctrine of discrete degrees, if you will, different levels of our being, and with the principles that we operate on this level being reflections of the principles that operate on a different level. It's his language that of the difference between feelings being what we are and being people who have feelings, being able to become conscious of those feelings. Mm-hmm. And then even to some extent articulate them and make decisions about them in regard to them. We're no longer just simply controlled by them. Mm-hmm. Trevor's standing up and Lee's raising his hand. I'll give Lee precedence over his big brother.
Just then very quickly, you mentioned about the prophets being where the compassion starts to come in. That can be thought of as a transition to the New Testament,
yeah,
where the outward legalisms are almost buried. They're there, but they're so inconsequential compared to the inner realities and the way they're expressed toward others in outward life, where living with justice and compassion becomes the path as opposed to doing the outward observance.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.